The federal government agreed last week to start a year-long review to see if the spring run of Klamath River Chinook salmon should be on the endangered species list. The numbers of the fish are disturbingly low, but that is true of many salmonid runs in California. We'll talk about the specific issues facing the Klamath spring Chinook, but I also take a broader look at migratory fish all over California. Last year saw the release of State of Salmonids, SOS-2, fish in hot water, packaged and distributed by Cal Trout. We have the lead author of that report with us again. Peter Moyle is professor emeritus at UC Davis and associate director of the Center for Watershed Sciences there. Thank you for joining us, Dr. Moyle.
Oh, you're most welcome. Glad to be here.
And the Karuk tribe, and the Salmon River Restoration Council pushed for the Klamath Spring Chinook listing. Craig Tucker is natural resources policy advocate for the Karuk tribe and our guest once again. Craig, thanks for joining us.
Hey, thanks for having me.
So give us the numbers here. I mean, every time I hear them, they're just as shocking as the last time, but we're really talking about a really poorly performing salmon run now, aren't we?
Yeah, we have spring Chinook salmon in the Klamath system is really in the hundreds of individual fish, and they're literally counted by hand by volunteers who swim reaches of the Salmon River. Also in the South Fork of the Trinity, there's a small population there. So we're really hand counting these fish, and if we don't do something immediately, we're simply going to lose them.
You're talking hundreds of fish where there were once hundreds of thousands. Is that the correct comparison?
Yeah, a lot of folks think that spring Chinook salmon were probably the dominant run of fish in the Klamath system and a lot of these Pacific Northwest rivers. And these runs have largely been impacted by dam building because these fish come in early in the year when flows are high and they try to reach up reaches of watersheds where they spend the summer kind of hanging out. So they need a cold place to hang out all summer long until they spawn in the fall. So dams have prevented this migration.
So this is a really interesting thing, though, about this fish run, is that, they enter the river much earlier than the fall run, but spawn at about the same time. Is that right?
Yeah, they're called premature migrators because they enter the system before they're sexually mature. So they come into the freshwater system, hang out for the summer while their gonads develop, and they spawn in the fall and die. And in some places, there's some overlap in the spawning between spring and fall run fish.
So do the spring fish being not even sexually mature yet, I mean, do they have to get their food provided in the river? I mean, because they don't come in from the ocean all fat, it sounds like.
No, actually, one reason why people love spring Chinook and they're sort of a delicacy is they come in full of body fat so that they have enough body fat on them to live all summer long. And so when you eat spring Chinook, you can really taste the difference because that extra body fat is really what gives them the flavor.
Wow, okay. We learn new things about fish all the time. Peter Moyle, I want to come to you. Anything about what's going on with the Klamath River spring Chinook differ from anything that you included in the State of Salmonids 2 report, Fish in Hot Water?
No, not really. But one of the new developments that allows this listing petition to happen is the work that's done by geneticists at UC Davis that show that this premature migration that spring run have coming up as immature fish has a strong genetic basis and is a result of a long evolutionary history of this fish, so that if you eliminate the fish, you also eliminate this very distinctive life history. Those of us who have worked on these fish have known for decades, really, that they are very distinctive, but the agencies have resisted giving them special protection in the past because they argued that the genetics weren't clear enough to protect them, and now we have that evidence.
Are there hard and fast guidelines then? I mean, about how different genetically any population has to be from another? I mean, does it have to be a difference in DNA base pairs? I mean, where do they make the decisions about this is this kind of fish and this is that kind of fish?
Well, that's a good question because it's somewhat arbitrary, but the Mashemine Fisheries Service looks for fish that they can describe as evolutionary significant units, which simply means fish that they think are on a distinct evolutionary pathway that, given a long enough time, they would become separate species. And that spring run Chinook now really fits that definition quite well.
So you could have identical fish in two different places, but if they're one's a captive species or something, which wouldn't happen with salmonids, I gather, but they potentially would be on very different evolutionary paths.
Yes, that's right, and that's why we have these different runs of Chinook that are protected in the and coho that are protected in the state already, based on their evolutionary history.
Craig Tucker, in asking the National Marine Fisheries Service, which is alternatively called the National Oceanic Atmospheric Administration Fisheries Service, for the listing, I mean, had this been requested before?
Yeah, a few years ago, some groups petitioned to have Klamath Chinook listed, but the evidence was not at that time compelling enough for the agency. And what's really happened in the last few years, it's gotten easier and cheaper to sequence the entire DNA of individual fish quickly and for cheap. So the resolution at which we look at the DNA sequence of these animals has increased dramatically. So now you could take a scale from a fish, you can mail it off, and in a few days you get the entire DNA sequence back. You can do that for dozens or hundreds of individuals, put all that in a computer for analysis, and it can kind of compare the DNA sequences side by side, and it helps the researchers do the detective work to find the exact spot in the fish's DNA that's different between a springfish and a fall fish. And really what Dr. Miller and his group at UC Davis found is kind of revolutionizing the thinking about how salmon evolved over time. They used to argue that these fish sort of evolved differences by watershed and then later evolved this spring run behavior. So like Klamath fish evolved it at the same time that Columbia River fish were evolving it. Well, what Miller's work shows is the spring run behavior evolved first, much earlier, and then they differentiated into the watershed. So he's really sort of rewriting the evolutionary history of salmon. So it's sort of exciting just from a kind of that nerdy evolutionary history piece. But it argues strongly that if we lose spring salmon on the Klamath, they're not likely to show up again for another 15 or 20 million years. And so it makes a compelling argument that they need to be protected.
Right. So nobody wants to wait around for 15 or 20 million. Obviously wouldn't be in a position to do so. You know, we're talking about Klamath spring run Chinook salmon proposed for listing under the Federal Endangered Species Act by the Karuk Tribe and the Salmon River Restoration Council. Craig Tucker is Natural Resources Policy Advocate for the tribe. Peter Moyle is Professor Emeritus at UC Davis and the Associate Director at the Center for Watershed Sciences. And his work is he's got the primary authorship in what became SOS2, State of Salmonids 2, Fish in Hot Water, about trouble for salmonids all over the state of California, out last year. Join the conversation on the exchange. You may have many questions or some comments about the whole process of preserving fish. 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. Peter Moyle, as you look across the breadth of California, is this the population that seems in the greatest danger, or is there some that's even in worse shape?
Yeah, that's true. You know, the California is actually a remarkable state in that its diversity of salmon and trout is really quite high. We have 32 different kinds of salmon and trout in the state, that are most of which are found only in California. And we've already lost one species from the state. That's the bull trout. And what we're finding is that most of the salmon and trout in the state are in trouble of one sort or another, and in fact, half of them, 14 of the 32 kinds that we have in the state, are already listed by the state and federal government. So this is just not an opinion. It's really verified by the way the agencies manage things. And we're looking at other species being similarly on the general decline. And really what all this means is that if we don't take the kind of actions we've been talking about, we'll lose a lot of these fish in the next 50 to 100 years.
You're looking at the current rate, 45% likely to be extinct in the next 50 years.
Yes, those are the ones that are in the most trouble. Mm-hmm. The ones that the species like coho salmon, for example, which once had runs of 100,000 to 200,000 fish on the North Coast in the 1950s, is now down to just a few thousand fish, and it's the runs that are strongly influenced by hatcheries. So, yeah, this is very real that we can lose these fish.
Craig Tucker, I think you mentioned briefly the Klamath River dams, and of course four are slated for removal potentially beginning in about 2 years. The actual physical process might start, assuming all the paperwork goes through between now and then. Are the dams the major issue? I mean, if you're talking about fish migrating to the upper reaches of a river system, that would seem to be the greatest obstacle.
Yeah, and I think that's the good news piece of this story, at least for the Klamath, is dam removal seems to be becoming a reality slowly but surely. We still have a few regulatory hurdles to overcome. And, you know, these spring salmon used to go way up into Oregon, above Upper Klamath Lake into the Williamson and Sprague River systems. And so the dams on the Klamath are the primary factor, but we still have to make sure that tributaries like the Scott and the Shasta can accommodate these fish. And so we, in addition to dams, we do have to make sure that alfalfa farming and other forms of agriculture do not dewater our streams.
But Peter Moyle, in Fish in Hot Water, the report out last year, climate change was the leading factor you saw in fish runs declining, wasn't it?
Well, it's the leading factor in terms of what the future of these fish. You know, Craig is absolutely right in that there's lots of other things going on. Dams are certainly an important aspect of this, but when you go up and down the north coast of California, you find that the way the landscape's been managed over the past 50 years has also made a huge difference to these fish, logging especially, and has really destabilized hillsides, for example, and caused massive landslides that have created problems for fish in the past. And now we have a contemporary problem of pot growing in many of our wilderness areas that have a strong influence on coho populations. But climate change, just on top of everything else, these fish are in a decline anyway, and with climate change coming, it's already here, really, it just accelerates the other problems that are going on. That's why dam removal in the Klamath is actually fairly important, because it's something that helps to sort of counter the effects of climate change.
Well, I was going to ask about how those two things would interrelate, because it seems to stand to reason that if the decline is existing in places that don't have extensive dam systems, you could take out the dams, and with climate change, you could still lose the fish.
Well, and the thing about the Klamath dams is that most people don't seem to realize is that not only will they provide access to upstream areas, although there's lots of restoration that's needed in those upstream areas, but the dams themselves cover up some really good habitat. There are nice cold springs that come into the river right there at Iron Gate, where Iron Gate Reservoir currently covers the river. So just taking out the dams alone will expose better habitat for coho salmon and Chinook salmon in a reach of the main river that now, of course, is covered by reservoirs.
We're talking about, obviously, Klamath River Chinook salmon, the spring run proposed for listing and a federal review process initiated last week that could take up to a year. Peter Moyle is the principal author of SOS2, Salmonids. How does it work again? State of Salmonids 2. Oh, there he is. Okay. Fish in Hot Water. And Craig Tucker is with the Karuk Tribe as Natural Resources Policy Advocate. You can join us on the exchange at 800-838-3760 and jx@jeffnet.org. Craig, dams aside, there have been other restoration efforts in the Klamath system, haven't there?
Well, yeah. We've been working for a long time to restore habitat along the Klamath. And you know, in addition to dams, one thing we see on the Klamath that's a big factor is, you know, every time there's a big flood, people typically jump back in and build dikes and levees along the riverbanks. And what this has done is it's robbed the Klamath of these wetland-type features along the margins of the river. And that's where a lot of the juvenile fish would rear and feed. And so we've actually been going in and restoring what we call them is off-channel ponds, but it's wetlands along the margins of the river. And we actually go in with backhoes and bulldozers and rebuild this habitat. And, you know, the very next spring you can go to these places and they're chunk full of juvenile salmonids. So there are things that we can do. And some of these things, like building off-channel ponds, is relatively easy when you compare that to big efforts like dam removal. So we're doing the small stuff and the big stuff.
You know, it's interesting to think of, though, because there are things that people can do alongside rivers. You know, when you get bulldozers out there, you're going to shock a few people no matter what you're doing. And yet the fact is that we probably have a modern conception of what a river should look like that may not be what that river looked like traditionally. And I wonder how much the longstanding knowledge of the Karuk tribe helps that process.
Well, you know, my boss always tells me that it's about time that Western science catches up to traditional tribal knowledge. And I think the Spring Chinook listing effort's a good example of that. Like, I think Karuk people have known for a long time that spring salmon and fall salmon were different. There's different words in the Karuk language for these fish.
Really?
And so we're applying traditional tribal knowledge to fisheries restoration and increasingly applying that to forest, the way we manage the forest and the way we manage fire and put fire back on the landscape. And so what we're really doing is bringing traditional knowledge back, merging it with contemporary Western science, and the results are pretty amazing.
Let's take a call here. We have Clayton in Cave Junction on the line. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange. We're talking about fish primarily on the Klamath River with Craig Tucker and Peter Moyle. Hi, Clayton.
Hello.
Hi, what's on your mind?
Oh, I just wanted to know if they'd taken that gill net off the mouth of the Klamath.
All right, a gill net you want to know about. Thanks for that, Clayton. Appreciate it. Craig, what do you know?
So the Yurok tribe has a reservation at the mouth of the Klamath River, and they have a fairly recognized fishing right. So the way we manage the Klamath fishery is we know about how many fish we need to spawn in the wild to keep the population healthy. And so the fish in excess of that number are considered harvestable. And so some of those fish are harvested by commercial ocean-going fishermen. Some of those fish are harvested by in-river sports fishermen with a rod and reel. And some of those fish are harvested by Native American harvest. The Yurok tribe uses gill nets to harvest fish. Karuk uses dip nets, so a different technology. But it's a managed fishery, and the fish are counted. And in years like last year that have extremely low abundance, the tribes, I mean, the Yurok tribe, I think, harvested 160 salmon last year, which is, that's the lowest harvest of salmon in thousands of years for the Yurok people. So they do harvest fish with gill nets, but it's part of a managed fishery.
So when everybody pulls back, it's not just that the commercial fisheries pull back and the tribes get to take what they want. They also pull back as well.
That's right. And once fisheries managers figure out how many fish can be harvested, tribes get half and non-tribal people get half.
Peter Moyle, just for a basis of comparison, the run coming into the Rogue River this spring is supposed to be pretty good, and I'm just curious to know if there's any knowledge in your hands about why the Rogue seems to be doing so well when the Klamath isn't.
Yeah, that actually puzzles a lot of people because the numbers the numbers of fish coming into the Klamath and into the Sacramento system are very low. And so there's this surprisingly large number of people of fish coming back into the Rogue. It looks like it's just better management of the fish somehow, or the way the hatcheries are operated. But my impression is that it sort of puzzles everybody why those fish, why the Rogue River fish have been doing better than the runs further south.
Craig Tucker, I wonder if you have any conversations with conservation groups up on the Rogue River country about whether they've noticed marked effects from the removal of dams from the main stem of the Rogue.
Well, I was going to say Gold Ray Dam was removed not too long ago, so that could have an impact on the fishery. And so I think it takes time. You know, after you do something like a significant restoration event like dam removal, it takes a few years of data to really develop a clear picture of what's happening. But I would guess that dam removal has probably had a big impact on the Rogue.
Now, we were talking about take of fish based on that question from Clayton. I know the Pacific Fisheries Management Council meets starting Thursday of this week to set the commercial fishing seasons for this year. Is that an event either of you folks attend, Peter?
I'm sorry, could you repeat the question?
The Pacific Fisheries Management Council is going to meet starting Thursday of this week to set commercial fishing seasons. I wonder if that's something you either attend or track.
No, I'm not really been, haven't really been tracking what they've been doing. I suspect Craig has been, though.
Yeah, we follow it closely, and the way it works is the Pacific Fisheries Management Council is made up of commercial fishing interests, sport fishing interests, tribal fishing interests, and fisheries biologists from various state and federal agencies, and they come up with a recommendation based on the data and the projected return of salmon to the Klamath, and they make recommendations to NOAA fisheries for harvest allocation. And so it's really an important event for us. We do anticipate a better year this year than we had last year. I mean, I don't think it could be.
No.
Last year was atrocious. Indications are that we'll have a stronger run this year, but we're really worried because we're running headlong into another drought year that looks as, it literally looks as bad as the epic drought of 2014 and 2015.
Well, so that must be a tough case to make, though. It's like, you know, don't take all the fish this year because we might need them next year.
Well, we're just really, you know, when you have conditions like this, you run the risk of having an epic fish kill like we witnessed back in 2002.
Mm-hmm.
And so we're working right now with the Bureau of Reclamation and agricultural interests in the Upper Basin to try to figure out how to maintain flows in the river this summer. But we think we'll have a better fishing year, but we're really worried about fish being able to access spawning areas and reproducing. And it's not the run this year that will suffer from the drought, but it's the run 3 and 4 years from now that will.
Mm-hmm.
And if I could add to that,
sure,
I think this increases the importance of conservation on some of these cold water rivers that flow into the Klamath, the Shasta, some of the tributaries to the Scott River, Blue Creek, and the Lower Klamath. These become increasingly important for the conservation of Klamath River salmonids. Just because they maintain their cooler temperatures and are somewhat resistant to drought compared to so many other streams.
All right. Cold water is always the major thing, which explains, of course, the title again of last year's State of Salmonids Report, Fish in Hot Water, which is more literal than it might sound. Craig Tucker, I know there's a year for nymphs to consider the listing. Will it take a year, you think?
I'm sure they'll use all the time they're legally allotted is my guess. And it is an important question because our petition is specific to Klamath River spring Chinook, but the paper that we're referencing, he uses fish from a variety of watersheds mm-hmm. along the Pacific Northwest, and what the data really suggests that every watershed where there's a spring mm-hmm. Chinook salmon or a summer steelhead, which has the same genetic mechanism, could be listed.
All right, Craig Tucker and Peter Moyle, thank you so much.